what was the nature of the Reuther caucus after Reuther had had gotten had been elected and also got control of the executive board?
Well, he was vice president in charge of GM negotiations, and particular and all of Otto. And his, but his, let me correct that. Reuther, as first vice president, was in charge of GM, the pace setter. That made him number one vice president. He, from that base, ran for presidency and won, mainly with active left-wing support and quieting the active people and the right-wingers. He wanted to win over the people who had been supporting Addis and Thomas. Now, R.J. Thomas was a Murrayite and a kind of conservative business union guy, a worker all his life. Addis, George Addis, was more intellectualized, was my impression. And he was the guy who followed the CP line to some extent, considerable extent. Who knows whether he's a party member, it doesn't matter. Now, as Reuther moved to the right and picked up support from the more conservative elements in the union, he became more and more able to see he was going to get a majority on the executive board, not just win the presidency, but win a majority. Now, after he became president in 46, he was picking up strength right along by promising, in secret, people who were Addis and Thomasites that he would give them good jobs if he won. Now, that meant that he had people who were active in the structure, knew the business part of the union. It meant that instead of him owing them, the Reutherites who got him elected, he owed them. But if he gave the jobs, the full-time salary jobs, to Addis and Thomas people, they owed him everything.
So he owed the leftists, but he worked a deal with the Addis Thomas caucus, so that so he would end up having a bunch of yes people, so to speak.
At least that was true in my experience in Northern California and Southern California, all of California. The man who was international representative at the at Local 76 in Northern California, Phil Lerman, L-E-R-M-A-N. He came to me at one point and said, "I made it." And I didn't know he was running for anything. I was kind of surprised. "What do you mean you made it?" He says, "I made it over the bridge. When, now that Ruth is coming in, I'm going to stay on and I'll still be the international rep." The one who came after him was the biggest single Stalinist in the plant at Chevrolet, and the most anti-Reuther, and a guy who really hated my guts because I was building a Reuther caucus, Rebello. He had a brother named Pete who was my committeeman. He was the guy who wouldn't come around during the sit-down strike, just disappeared. This was his brother. I've forgotten his name, his first name, but he was a bad-boned guy. Now, Rex Maynard worked, I believe, in aircraft down here. And Rex Maynard was a Southwesterner from Oklahoma or Texas, and a lot of savvy, natural leader. And he worked hard, and he built a big Reuther caucus, and he brought in the vote for Reuther in Southern California area, big, because there was tremendous membership in Southern California as compared to Northern California. And it was felt that he would become education director. He was already acting in that role of holding educational conferences. And they stiff-armed him. And he had to go back in the plant. And he kept at it. He didn't die because he had to go back in the plant all of a sudden from a temporary outside job. That is, he was temporarily on the staff during a transition period. And here he was with no staff job at all. But it was easy to see that Ruther had betrayed us. And that he was not out to build any progressive big union. That he had built a Ruther caucus now at the expense of the rank-and-file caucus and the Addis Thomas caucus. And there was a one caucus and a one-party union as of 1948.
Did you feel it kind of made parties like the Workers' Party kind of made him look foolish after doing all this work?
Made him look no.
No, did it make? Did he? Was he? He really kind of made some of these leftists that worked for him look foolish.
Well,
people who had hoped to have get a position or get or maybe have a say in how the union was going to be.
Well, run. No, the those who worked hard for him at grassroots and wound up being right back in the shop again, like we were in Chevrolet. We didn't lose any respect at all. The people who lost credibility are the people who went so far overboard for Ruther from left. That is, I'm talking about people in the WP now who had been Shackmanites and very radical people. Those people who went on the staff, Sam Fishman was one of them. Sam Fishman was a very smart guy, very bright. He became the president of a local union in Detroit very rapidly. And then he was the president of, that local got dissolved. Then he became the president of the electromotive plant in southern Michigan, where the electromotive was a big corporation making trains, as I recall. Well, I picked up an issue of Look magazine, which was the number two magazine in the country, in and around 1948 or 9. And here's a 5 to 6 page spread on Sam Fishman. And they're doing a day in the life of Sam Fishman in the plant. He's the president, and it shows him walking with committeemen that are under his leadership and telling and instructing them on how to settle grievances and so on. It was the kind of job that you do as a reward. And I saw that and I said, he's going upstairs on staff. It was absolutely predictable. It was transparent. And he did. And he wound up technically on the in the Treasury with the who was the Mazur, Emil Mazur, was Secretary of Treasury, and he wound up in finances, running a lot of the key finances. As a matter of fact, he was the brain, the financial brain, and also he was utilized for his political savvy. He was the guy who cemented new alliances with business unionists. And he became a business unionist. Once I was talking to Al Glotzer, number two man in the organization, in the office in New York, and I mentioned Sam Fishman's name. And Glotzer turned like pale. And in shock, and said, "Never mention his name in this building." And I didn't have to ask any questions as to why he said it. He was covering for Fishman. He didn't want any connection between the Workers' Party or the Independent Socialist League, in Sam Fishman's name. They were trying to erase his tracks, and they were helping him erase his tracks. And I knew that we were had as an organization as well. Because the thing that had happened in the 48 convention, when Ruther got a majority in the executive board, the big event there was so disgraceful, not just to the Rutherites, but particularly to our people, how they acted, that nothing surprised me anymore. I knew it was all downhill, but there's no other place for me to go politically.
Did any of the people in your group slide out with you, so to speak? Or, I mean, this the whole Ruther thing kind of drove a wedge in the group.
Well, I think if I tell you the incident at the 48th convention, you'll understand better. The Addis Thomas people were pretty much defeated, pretty solidly defeated. And they lost out in all directions. But they put up a resolution, an anti-McCarthyite resolution, an anti-Taft-Hartley resolution, same thing at the time. Taft-Hartley Act had not yet been made credible or legitimated by labor itself. It was passed by the House and the Senate over the biggest flood of mail against new legislation that had ever been received in Washington, D.C. by 10 at that time. And they put up a resolution that we not sign these non-communists. The leading officials were going to be asked to sign them. And they put up a resolution saying we should not sign them. And Willoughby Abner, who was a bright young black guy, president of a local in Chicago, got up and really did a demagogic job that was totally expert. He went right through their entire record during the war. Look who's trying to act militant now. The Piecework Boys, the National Labor Conscription Boys, the guys who wanted to give it all back to the corporations are coming at us like the militants now. And it wound up, when that letter, that crescendo developed, boom, the vote was in favor of signing the non-communist affidavits as a way of driving the Addis Thomas people further out. And John L., he had made noises against it. He said, we shouldn't sign. Well, here, the biggest and most political union in the CIO goes for the non-communist affidavits. And that legitimated the whole Taft-Hartley Act. It killed all any hope that there's going to be any fight at all against the Taft-Hartley Act on the part of the union. Here was the hope of the labor movement, the most militant of the mass production unions, really selling out on this question. And the first we knew about on the West Coast was from Irving Howe and B.J. Wittig's book. B.J. Wittig did most of the writing, as I understand, because he was in Otto. He knew the inside. And Wittig and Howe, in that book, UAW and Walter Ruther, report that vote as a great victory. And their Stalinophobia was what is directing them. And Stalinophobia is already a defeatist attitude. When you are willing to, when you develop a phobia over something, you are no longer functioning level-headedly in a stable way. These people were no longer functioning as militants. They had lost hope in socialism. And they were going for careers being an anti-Stalinist, an anti-communist, allowed them to put the guise of having something progressive to do. That is, we're still progressive because we're fighting these reactionary communists. Well, the communists were reactionary, but no longer were the Reutherites a left-wing opposition to the Addis Thomas people. They were now business unionists, more like the Addis Thomas people than
the Addis Thomas people.
No, they were more like them than they were like themselves previously.
Yeah. It's kind of like they threw out the baby with the bathwater.
Everything went. That was, you could sum it up that way, but it's very interesting. These leftists, seeing that the war had really destroyed the basis of the socialist movement that had been built around the Russian Revolution and disintegrated it, no hope of being the left opposition to that anymore as Trotskyists. No hope of that. No hope. How can you... I mean, they had figured themselves as the left opposition to the communists. And the communists were already organized. And their hope was to someday take over and bring those people in the CP to them and to the left. With those people atomized organizationally, atomized out of the cities that they were in as displaced persons in large numbers, no longer with the people who made them effective, now dispersed. It was a diaspora of radicals, particularly on the Russian side. Because as the Red Army moved, they did away with people who had any left-wing reputation. Now, if you were in the Trotskyist movement from relatively early times, in the 30s, say, you joined with that as one of the given things that you could... You didn't have to start over from scratch. You could win the rank and file CPers to your Trotskyist organization. And now the CP is disintegrated everywhere. So it meant starting all over again. Now, it was very hard to be around like that at that time. And be that generation, or people who started when they were 13, 14 years old and the young Trotskyists with the same attitudes in the 30s. We who came in during the war came in because Trotskyists that we met were making sense of the world around us. They were providing us with an education. We weren't dependent upon that. In L.A., I didn't know from Borscht about world revolution. It was a screwball world, and here comes a Trotskyist, and he begins to make sense of that world to me. And then coming in the organization, the same thing. I owed him. I was obligated to him for doing that. And I never had counted on a world revolution to begin with. And the young ones of us who came in during the war, it was easier on us in that sense. You follow?
Yeah.
You see, am I making this clear, you think?
Yes, very clear, very clear.
So, the West Coast, which is the furthest away from New York and Chicago, where the conservative older types were, and they were all pretty young when the war started, in Detroit and Toledo and so on, they stayed with the Shackman line. We out here... were either Draperites or Sterlingites, followers of Max Sterling. And there was the Louisville branch that agreed with us.
Max Sterling, Max Shapiro.
Yes, exactly. Now, these guys, once they lost heart in the ideals and the hope of a new society, career became the thing. It freed them to go for career. That is, if you can't make it big, might as well break out the booze and let's have a ball, like Peggy Lee sings. You might as well go for a career if there's nothing possible. And, of course, they're forgetting about the rank-and-file workers they're supposed to be leading. And it was a disgrace. And UAW and Walter Reuther, by Howe and Wittig, stands to this moment, never been corrected by them. They've never rejected what exists in that book about voting for the non-communist affidavits.
Right. Which was as good as voting for Taft-Hartley.
Absolutely. It was cubed. A disgrace that was cubed by the fact that it was anti-red, in quotes, on the wrong basis. And it was pro-Taft-Hartley. This total disgrace.
Draper, Sterling, now out here, they break from Shackman.
No.
Not really?
As long as Draper was out here, Draper was the only major anti-labor partyite left in the party. He opposed the Labor Party. He had a big following. Frankly, the entire San Pedro branch is the largest branch in the country outside New York. And at the end of the war, Shackman got him to go to New York and become editor of Labor Action in the New International. And suddenly, without any warning, there was a Labor Party pamphlet appeared by Jack Ranger, with a foreword to it by Hal Draper. This was in 45. And he hadn't told any of his followers here that he had changed to a pro-Labor Party position. So that he was now in a position of being a leading member of the apparatus, head of the newspaper and magazine. But he was at the same time resentful and when he saw the price he was paying, obviously. And he never said that to me, but it seemed to me pretty apparent. That is, when we went into the Socialist Party in 1958, Draper was one of the most anti-unity people in the leadership. And he came to the Bay Area, and we stayed in the SP less than a year, and it was Draper who made it possible for us to get out and form the Independent Socialist Club, and finally the IS.
Mm-hmm. When was
so that one? And people are complex. Now here he'd done something that was wrong, in my opinion, and opinion of his own people, political followers. But it didn't mean that was the end of the world for him. He made a comeback and he fought well. And we have to judge people without stereotyping them. I mean, if we'd wipe them off the face of the earth and out of the human race, just totally rejected him, we wouldn't have gotten the benefit of his efforts later on. Now, in San Francisco, there was no rapprochement between Sterling, Shapiro, and Shackman. As a matter of fact, at war's end, there was a lid on going to Europe. Party intellectuals were quitting the plants because the plants had shut down around them. Like here in the shipyard shut down. Here are 24 shipyard workers who are New Yorkers, go back to New York, and a lot of them want to go to Europe. And the party says, no, you got to stay. And there was discipline there. And Shapiro simply got himself a ship and went to Europe. And Shackman expelled him, boom, just like that. And that was the end of Shapiro in the Workers' Party. Now, he knew that they'd get him if he went. And in a way, he left us high and dry in Frisco. He was a leader, and he acted like he didn't have a group to lead when the end of the war came. Because he, too, felt there was nothing left in Europe. The Workers' Party was a European movement. It wasn't really an American movement. People were steeped in Europeanism, in European politics, in the writings of Trotsky. In the German Revolution, the Spanish Revolution, etc.
Did you feel stranded by the WP or the besides the Shapiro thing? Did you feel kind of out of
Well, I had a big argument with Shapiro. I was the closest one to him in the movement, and I didn't read the riot act at him and say, you're no fucking good and that's the end of you and me. I didn't do that. But I really kept at him to make him explain what he was doing. And finally, he couldn't. Finally, he said, will you allow me this rest so I can have some peace of mind? I'll make some money over here in Europe, and I'll be able to write. And of course, he never wrote. He never made any money. And he stayed in Europe for 15 years, maybe 20.
So when did you, sometime around this time, you end up down in Los Angeles? Is that
51 to 56. 51 to 50, yeah.
Were you still a party member when you came down to L.A.?
Yeah, sure. It's strange. Things go wrong, but if very recent in your memory, there's this tremendous obligation and respect. I found that I had the ability to carry critical attitudes against the people around me and still go on.
Without alienating yourself?
Well, I alienated people here in L.A. In the Bay Area, people were in industry, they were industrial workers. We held at least one meeting a week. A branch meeting every week, and exec meetings, that's two a week. So I got here, and the people in 1951, the people were all pretty much getting ready to become inactive because of McCarthyism. Mm-hmm. Most of them, not all.
Did you try within the factory? Did you try organizing when you were in Ottawa in L.A.? Did you approach factory workers?
Well, first of all, I led that rebellion in the Teamsters Union here, in Local 926 or 8, I've forgotten which. And during that period, we still had a branch here. And when I was in the fight over that, with the Teamsters, very few of the people. And you got to realize that after leading this revolt in the Teamsters Union, and the Teamsters and Lieutenant Stevens, the Red Squad, following me around town, getting me fired from every job I would get for quite a while, over a year. I could only get jobs that friends would get from me, things like that, and briefly. I finally saw in 1955 ad in the paper, L.A. Times or Examiner. GM was hiring another shift, and I knew I had a job. If I get through the door and tell them I was a spray painter, bam, they don't care, they hire me. GM didn't feel threatened by anybody. And I got that job, but because of having been blackballed, and I made, in those 2 years that I was blackballed, or almost 2 years, something like $1,300 in wages. And I was living like a church mouse. And I had babies and a wife. And we were living close to the... Well, anyway. I just went in there, and I was like a regular worker. I was living on the east side, and I was in a ride group with four Mexican guys that I halfway knew. I knew some of their brothers. I was a little older than they were. In East L.A., and a couple of them lived in Lincoln Heights, and we...
You were living in East L.A. also?
East L.A., and then I moved to Highland Park. And in this ride group, and in the group that I was with in the factory on the line, that's where I discovered the informal work group whole idea. But I wasn't doing anything for the party. I wasn't trying to recruit anyone. I was just shutting up and watching and learning. And I learned more by shutting up than by talking. Far more. And because it took all the energy I had, in effect, I quit being the leader of the branch. I was only nominally the leader of the branch. And when I